Napa know-how.
Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolored paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
Out of the third quarter, it's Kemba fires it and makes it.
All right, welcome back, Hornets fans and BuzzBeat listeners. I'm your host, Spencer Percy, and along with me, as always, is my co-host, Richie Randall. So we got plenty to discuss today. We got a Kemba Walker being named an Eastern Conference All-Star. This is the first one since Gerald Wallace in 2010 for Charlotte. Hornets are on yet another losing streak. And we're also going to talk about some of the ACC's best draft prospects. Potentially a conversation the Hornets are going to have to start having here pretty soon. So, Richie, how are you doing, man?
Doing pretty good. I guess I could be doing a little bit better with the way that the Hornets have been playing lately. My wife and I went out to drinks before the game, so I had to watch that game on delay. Maybe I should have had drinks after the game, after watching that one.
Yeah, before and after would have been very fitting, but just be happy you didn't have to. You didn't have to watch that game live, and you could rewind and fast forward, as you pleased. So today we've got a really special guest with us, actually the first guest we've had so far on BuzzBeat. So Brian Geisinger is with us from Sports Channel 8. So they kind of cover all of North Carolina. If you follow Sports Channel 8 on Twitter, you might be pleased with the fantastic ACC GIF recap, let me say. If you've never seen one of those, you have got to go follow at Sports Channel 8 and find a way to look at one of the ACC sports or ACC basketball GIF recaps. So it's just basically a recap of all ACC basketball in a GIF format, and it's the funniest thing on the internet in North Carolina. So if you haven't seen that, go see that now. Brian is kind of, I would say, like a stats Jedi on Twitter for everything Hornets. I mean, he's got some of the best, most in-depth analysis and stats for the Charlotte Hornets. So Richie and I have been wanting to bring him on for a while, so we're really glad that he's finally here with us. If you're not following him, go ahead and do that. He's at BGEIS_Bird on Twitter. So Brian, it's great to have you, man. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be the first guest, and I will pass along to my guy, the Weather Moose on Twitter. He's kind of the curator of those GIF recaps, and he's kind of the Picasso of that and of Photoshop. And he's a vain guy too, so he'll be very flattered with the praise there. But would have liked to have seen a Hornets victory last night. We're in kind of another one of those rough patches, but overall, doing pretty well, and I'm happy to be on here today.
Awesome. Yeah, so I actually passed along the NC State GIF recap of when they beat Duke and Durham to one of my buddies who is an avid Pac fan and went to NC State, and he replied, and he was like, wow, man, that's literally everything that I felt in 40 minutes of basketball that night. So, all right, guys, well, let's get started. So once again, we got a lot to cover today, and I think the logical place to start would probably be the Kemba being named an All-Star, but I think we're actually going to start with the Golden State game, recap that game, a game that really looked like the Hornets could have won, maybe should have won, but Golden State kind of flexes their muscle there in the fourth quarter. The Hornets go cold and end up losing that game by 10. The bright spots in that game, I thought Kemba obviously played well. He might have outplayed Steph. Hornets, I thought they defended the three-point line really good against an obviously powerful Golden State shooting team. Overall defense, I thought it was pretty good from Charlotte that night. Guys, let's start with you, Richie. What are some of the things you took away from the Golden State game? And we'll get into Clifford's comments as well. But some of the things you said, okay, look, we played the best team in the league. maybe one of the best teams the league's ever seen, and we competed and really had, you know, gave ourselves a chance to win the game. What are some of the things you took away as positives?
As positives, I would definitely say defense for most of the most of the game. You know, we did defend the 3-point line to a certain extent. I wouldn't say that was the one place that they killed us in. But then again, I don't think it was that all, you know, outstanding. I think the pick and roll game was very difficult with Golden State, because when you have to guard that, they have shooters everywhere. And if you're trying to fight through the screens and you get behind, they're going to have an open shooter somewhere. And Hibbert was not fit to play this game with these high pick and rolls. There was a lot of times in which Curry came off a high pick and roll and, you know, Hibbert, that his natural self, just drops back. And then Curry would, you know, chuck up those threes, and he did all right with the 3-point shot. Other than that, it was pretty much just all Kemba. A lot of his points came out on drives to the rim, and he's getting really good at that, like, inside hand layup, if you know what I mean, like where he's dribbling it with his right hand. He's got his, you know, shielding the defender, and then he just kind of goes straight up. You know, it saves some time in that way, and he did a good job of getting into the paint.
Yeah, I thought so, and you're right about that layup. He gets it to his right hand, and another thing, kind of piggyback off that comment, Richie, is when he comes off that ball screen, Kemba has done really good throwing the ball out in front of him. So, you know, the defender, if they swipe at it, really they're just going to swipe at his hand. He throws the ball out. He's quick enough to go get it, keeps it in that right hand, and flips it right up there. Brian, a few takeaways on the positive side of things from this game for you.
I thought MKG was fantastic. He's been on kind of a roll recently. He was aggressive earlier. Golden State was giving him that kind of free safety look where I think Draymond was matched up with him for a few possessions, and Golden State likes to do this where they want Draymond to be able to kind of roam the court. So if they're playing Oklahoma City, he'll guard Andre Roberson, and he was kind of doing that with MKG. And I thought Mike made him pay with a mid-ranger and got involved with some cuts and offensive rebounds, which is kind of how he looks for his offense. But 15 points, 7 of 12 shooting, 9 boards, 2 blocks. He was one of only 2 Hornets with a positive net rating, Hibbert being the only other one. And I thought he did a great job on Klay Thompson. So I would kind of highlight Mike as having a good game, but that's just kind of what we've come to expect the last few weeks from him. I thought Kemba had a nice game too. Neither he and Steph had their best games, but I thought he played them – to maybe kind of a toss-up, and that's just what you can kind of expect from Kemba these days. He's not going to get outplayed, really, by any of the top guys, and he's been better at times than Kyrie this year, Lillard, Kyle Lowry, Reggie Jackson, Isaiah Thomas. So it was just another time where you got to see him go heads up against one of the best in the world. And again, I thought he held his own. So those were definitely some of the positives I would take away. The starting lineup, that, you know, no Cody Zeller, unfortunately, and I'm guessing that's something we'll get to. But the starters with Roy Hibbert, a net rating of almost 25 points, plus 25 in 16 minutes. And the four normal starters plus Hibbert scored over better than 1.3 points per possession, which is really, really, really good. I mean, that would be the best offense in the NBA by a mile. Kemba, Kidd Gilchrist, Frank Kaminsky, Spencer Hawes, and Bellinelli scored a better than 1.2 points per possession, and they played at a really fast pace, which I thought was interesting, about 110 possessions per game. So those were some of the good parts that I took from this game. Starters played great, especially MKG.
And to kind of go off Brian's point, I feel like our best lineup has been our starting lineup for the past, you know, month. So all right. These bench lineups that we've been, you know, tinkering with, if you look at their net rating, it's not been good. It's always been the starters, and that's kind of been the difficulty with this team.
Yeah, no, definitely. And Brian, I also really like your point about MKG. I mean, I thought he was awesome. All of a sudden, here in the last week and a half, he's finishing at the rim. And not only that, but he just looks much more confident and aggressive when he makes the move towards the rim. You know, he's dunking more often. He's not, Richie, we've talked about it, he's not really hunting that contact. You know, he's focusing on when he gets in the air, when he gets close to the rim, go ahead and finish. So you're there, dunk it or lay the ball off the glass. Do not worry about the extra body or the help defender, you know, coming in. Just go ahead and finish the play. You're strong enough and skilled enough to do it. And he's been doing a really good job at finishing at the rim here in these probably last 3 or 4 games. I would say probably definitely the last 3 games. But, yeah, so I've been really impressed with that on MKG. And then the confidence to just keep letting the mid-range jumper go Brian, you could probably touch on that with some stats. I think maybe you had something the other day on his his mid-range jumpers recently.
Yeah, in the last 20 games here, from 15 to 19 feet, MKG 47%, from 16 to 24 feet, 42%. Over the last seven games here, his averages 11 points, 9 rebounds, 3 of those offensive, 48% field goal percentage, 1.6 assists, 1.4 blocks, and an 85% clip from the free throw line. He's been fantastic. And as you can see, that jumper, the mid-range, he makes it enough that teams have to at least honor it. And if they don't, he's going to make it one out of every two times, which is a nice weapon to have.
Yeah, they still aren't respecting him from out there. I mean, which is probably true for the most part. But yeah, he's getting those open looks.
Yeah, definitely.
They're not. Teams are still not going to, you know, actively take that away, and they're not even going to pretend like it's a real thing. And that would probably continue for a while. But you know, the other thing is that the MKG, he's a top three cutter in the NBA, and not the way he cuts, but the way he understands where the cut should come from and when it should come. So he's, you know, just a minute ago, Brian was kind of explaining Draymond's role on the court as kind of the free safety. MKG is really good at watching the eyes of that free safety guy, that one sagging to the paint. When that guy turns his eyes and Kemba goes on dribble penetration or Batum or whoever it is, but MKG goes baseline right behind the guy. That's how he gets a lot of his layups. So, you know, you can sag off of him and pretend like he's not out there, but there are enough counters for the Hornets. We just mentioned MKG's improved mid-range jumper. We just mentioned, you know, his improved ability to finish at the rim. And then the way he cuts and his high IQ there, you know, the Hornets can make you pay if you help off of him. He's not just a guy standing out there offensively.
Yeah, I'll add this too. MKG off of cuts this season, 1.21 points per possession, shooting 60% from the field, which is pretty darn good. If you turn your back to him, he's going to go straight to the rim. He burned, I believe, Courtney Lee last night, at least on one occasion, where Lee turned his back and he just zipped straight to the rim there.
Exactly. So really good to see from MKG, and probably with the bright spot here in another Hornets three-game losing streak we've seen recently. MKG, not the reason for that. He's really played strong and played great defense against some really good players. All right, so low points of this game. You know, I thought a few things that I noted. The Hornets turning the ball over. Let's see. They had 14, for that game, I think, 14 turnovers. I mean, that's going to get you beat against most teams if you're Charlotte, but especially Golden State. So I thought the turnovers – you know, Kevin Durant, I don't know if it's a low point. He's just the guy's just unguardable. You know, at times he kind of gets his, goes for 33. Yeah, I thought the bench, I mean, we're going to talk about it again later, but, and Richie, you mentioned it a minute ago. You just can't survive with those guys. You can't survive with Hawes, Bellinelli, Kaminsky, these guys on the floor for extended minutes. I mean, we don't, it's just proven. Like, you can't survive with them. And the Hornets, again, couldn't do it in extended time against Golden State on Wednesday. So those are some of the things that I had. Richie, anything that I didn't mention there?
No, I would agree. I just kind of piggyback off your, you know, the bench pitfalls there. The second quarter, they scored 19 points, had 6 turnovers, allowed 7 fast break points, and had an offensive rating of 73.1. I mean, that's awful. You know, that's kind of typical of our second quarters, just bad offensive play.
Yeah, absolutely. Brian, I want to ask you here, what, you know, when you watch the bench against Golden State in all these games, you know, what do you see? Do you see a lineup that you think works best? I mean, does Clifford, I guess here's a better way to ask it. Does Clifford need to stagger these starter minutes where he almost has 2 starters on the floor at all times? Because he still hasn't done it. When he has done it with like a Batum, Marvin out there with a collection of 3 bench guys, you know, obviously that stops the bleeding to an extent, but are we at the point where like that has to become kind of an all-time thing? Because I think we've seen if 4 of those bench guys are out there together, it's just death.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, what's the definition of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. When you do the bench 4 plus Batum or plus MKG, like you just highlighted, it gets pretty ugly, specifically against Golden State. Batum with the bench, that's Sessions, Kaminsky, Hawes, and Bellinelli. They scored 36 points per 100 possessions, which is just terrible. They had a net of minus 84 points per 100 possessions in 6 minutes. Also against Golden State, the bench 4, but with MKG as opposed to Batum, 77 points per 100 possessions, a net rating of minus 46. And I think that was in a probably, 4 minutes of action. I would like to see them stagger minutes a little bit more. I thought during the home stretch where they had a little bit of luck, I'd noticed, I wasn't exactly time stamping this, but I thought Clifford was actually bringing Marvin back in earlier and then subbing Marvin out with the around the last, maybe like the last 2 minutes of the first half, and was bringing Kaminsky back in to run with the starters. And that's a lineup, a five-man group that actually has a pretty good point differential this year. And then he was getting Marvin back in to kind of, kind of in support of either Batum or MKG, just so there were more, at least two starters on the court at all times. But I couldn't agree with you more. If you follow this team, you know, if those four, Clifford plays a nine-man rotation, especially with Lamb out of the lineup, and him coming, Jeremy Lamb coming back should help a little bit too. But when it's four of those bench guys, it gets real ugly real quickly, especially when Zeller's out, and then you're cutting into your depth even more. And I think they got to get a little more creative, whether that's to just totally mix it up and play smaller and just keep to have more of these guys on the court at the same time. You play MKG at the power forward a little bit more. You play Kaminsky at the five a little bit more, along with Marvin. Whatever you got to do, you got to mix it up a little bit here if I'm Clifford. And I think they should have tried. I love Steve Clifford. I kind of wish this is something he had maybe explored a little bit more a couple weeks ago, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to save some of this conversation till later. But that last point you made, and Richie and I have talked about the Marvin thing, coming in, playing with the bench, noticing the difference, because he can give you a lot on both ends of the floor, as opposed to a guy like MKG out there with the bench. But so in the Houston game, when Charlotte made that massive comeback and Clifford was out there with Marvin really at the four and Kaminsky at the five, but he had Marvin – on he had him on Harrell, so basically Marvin is the quasi defensive center in that case, so you can put him into the pick and roll defense situations, and then you move Kaminsky onto the corner spacer or the four, whatever it is. That had a ton of success against James Harden, really one of the best ball handlers, probably the best ball handler and pick and roll creator in the NBA. I don't know why Clifford has not gone back to that or experimented with that. That would have worked again last night. Kyle O'Quinn is not an overimposing center, behemoth center that you can't stick Marvin on and say, go get in this guy's space, blitz ball screens. We don't have to respect his role to the point where, it terrifies us. I don't know why he hasn't rediscovered or at least tried that more often, because they had so much success in that comeback in Houston. But we're going to discuss this bench stuff a little bit more later. The last thing I wanted to ask you guys, did Kemba outplay Steph on Wednesday night?
I think it was a wash. I really do. I mean, I think that Curry's not the greatest defender, and I think that Kemba kind of burnt him a couple times on pick and rolls and getting to the rim. But I wouldn't say that he outplayed him significantly. It was just more of a wash to me. And he did have that one play where it looked like he broke his ankles, but I think Steph just kind of stepped on, the screener's foot. But other than that, I mean, it seemed like a wash to me.
Yeah, I tend to agree with Richie there. I thought Kemba played well. Again, like I kind of said, I'm kind of harping back to what I said earlier. At the worst, he's going to play all these guys, the best players in the world as a toss-up. I thought he got some good looks out of those horn sets. That's an automatic. Kemba, if he dribbles left off that, he's going to shoot a three, or he can get to a spot in the mid-range. And I thought he burnt Golden State with that a couple times the other night. And I would like to, before we move on, two other quick – I failed to mention these earlier. Two other quick, just real quick, positive observations from the Golden State game. I thought Charlotte did a really nice job attacking Golden State switches. They were trying to switch everything, and I thought with some slips – and some cuts, Charlotte was able to get some nice looks at the hoop. And I thought the big-to-big passing was also pretty good. Spencer Hollis had five assists in the game against Golden State, too. So I meant to mention those things earlier. So a couple other positives to take from the loss to the Warriors the other night.
It was weird, though. They were switching not on picks, but they were switching on these cuts from, Bellinelli, who was coming up for, a three, which I didn't understand. And then you had these backdoor passes that were wide open. It happened in the Knicks game, too.
Yep.
Yeah, so the Hornets did a really good – well, the Golden State is so good at taking away the three-point line. And if you see how they switch those ball screens, they switch them. They don't go under or over. I mean, they switch it right there at the three-point line. So as soon as that guy's coming off the ball screen or the dribble handoff, the guy is not guarding him in a flat situation, so to speak, but he's actually facing him face to face. So, you know, the Hornets came into that game knowing, okay, we want to get five out as much as possible, five guys outside of the three-point line, and we run these dribble handoffs with Spencer, bring Bellinelli off these staggers and pin down screens. You know, the guy setting the screen or the guy with the dribble handoff just sprint to the rim. And if their weak side help is not there or just a little bit lackadaisical, we're going to get layups. And they did plenty of that against Golden State. And they also got some of that against New York last night. Hollis got that wide open layup late in the game with Batum, made that, you know, incredible bounce pass. It was the same kind of action, just slip right to the rim after a five out action, and you can get layups. That's how you get Spencer Hollis engaged right there. So, all right, so let's move to last night. So we're recording this on a Saturday morning, so we're fresh off of a brutal New York loss last night in MSG. Richie, I'm going to start with you. Probably the most frustrating Hornets game I've had to watch all year. It felt like a game the Hornets really needed. They're right there, up six with under 5 minutes to go, and they can't close the game out. What's the most frustrating aspect of that loss for you?
I'm not sure. It was just an odd game to watch because I felt like, you know, even though we never pulled away from the Knicks, I felt like we were in control of the game. Like, I don't feel like the lead got like that great on our end. But in that fourth quarter where we just stalled for like 5 minutes, it was like, okay, guys, we got to put them away. And that's, looking back at the previous quarters, maybe we should have expanded the lead a little bit more, because I feel like we were just kind of going through the motions. We were playing against the Knicks, and that fourth quarter, they came back, and Courtney Lee, you know, scoring all those baskets against his old team, you know, sparked their offense. And then they kind of had a deja vu with Carmelo Anthony hitting that dagger on the left side. So it was frustrating just to lose to the Knicks, I guess. But I mean, it's just a strange game to watch. Strange game.
Yeah. I thought this game was the number one case study to, you know, why Kemba needs offensive help. You know, at the end of that game, you know, the Hornets are up 99-93, you think, man, if we can get one more bucket here, you know, you start to feel like the defense can close this thing out. And the Hornets offense just stalls, you know, and they do not have another option outside of Kemba to go get a bucket. And really the problem is that you see Kemba at the end of the game, he's gassed. He needs possessions off of the ball. You know, that's part of why Batum's out there, to get Kemba off the ball more. But, you know, I'm not talking about getting him off the ball, bringing, you know, stagger screen or action to him. I'm talking about somebody else stepping up and going to get a basket when that guy is just too tired to take it all on his shoulders. And last night, I think you saw that late in the game. He was gassed. You know, he was trying to get away from the ball and let Batum, you know, work for a few minutes. And Batum has just not been capable of it, especially here in the past month or so. So I think last night was case study number one of, until the Hornets get another score, another guy that can go get his own bucket, create his own shot, they're not going to be able to hold these leads, especially against teams that that have some offensive firepower. So I thought that was the most frustrating aspect to this game for me, but there were many, and we're going to walk through some of them. Brian, anything you saw through those four quarters that made you want to pull your hair out? Just one thing.
Yeah,
I know you probably got five.
I would say honestly the final 8 minutes, Bellinelli, after he made the last shot, they were stuck at nine. They were stuck at 99 points for almost like over 6 minutes. And in the final 8 minutes of the game, only 0.5 points per possession, a net of minus 60. They were only 3 of 16 shooting after that Bellinelli make, 1 of 10 on threes. And they had 4 turnovers and let New York shoot a little under 50% to close out. And Lee stuck some big shots for them too. That was clearly the most frustrating part for me, especially because New York they're a dumb basketball team. Like, they were, Courtney Lee was killing the Hornets down the stretch, and they're still running isolations and post ups for Carmelo. And of course, he sticks the dagger. But by the way, he was 6 for 20 on contested shots last night. So it was just, it's a frustrating loss to lose to them. Porzingis was cooking earlier in the game, and then they just totally went away from him, actually. And it's frustrating to lose kind of a must win, but to lose a very important game against a team that I just don't think very highly of, even though I like Hornacek as a coach and stuff like that.
Yeah, I thought that, you know, I thought that this game was a Courtney Lee revenge game. There in the end, It's like you could see it on his face. It was jumping off the screen to me. That guy wanted it so bad late in that game. He definitely has something out for Charlotte. I mean, just the way he played late last night in the fourth quarter is proof to that. I mean, he you know, has some red ass for not being valued as much as he thought he should have been by the Hornets, and he let him know that with it, with his performance, scoring those six straight points and tying the game last night. And then to Brian's point, the offense is dead. Melo finally makes a contested jumper, and that pretty much does it. So, all right, just kind of scanning through. You know, I thought I do want to give New York some credit here. They had a balanced scoring attack last night. You know, as bad as Carmelo was, you know, you all of a sudden you look up, you know, Porzingis gets his 18, Courtney Lee gets 16, Derrick Rose, who only played 21 minutes after he leaves the game with an injury, still gets 13, had a good first half. Brandon Jennings comes off the bench. He might have been the difference, honestly. He gets 15, and I really think Brandon Jennings, the reason he plays so much in that second half, obviously, you know, Derrick Rose is out, but, man, he really wore Kimba down with his energy, I thought. I thought that played as much of a factor late in this game to the Hornets kind of losing steam offensively as anything. Brandon Jennings, man, golly, he just made Kimba work for everything on both ends of the floor, and I think it took a lot out of Kimba. And then Kyle O'Quinn, you know, he gets 10 points, 7 important rebounds, a few big offensive rebounds. So, you know, as frustrating as it is, to Brian's point, to lose to a team that you feel like is just not a very – well-run team, a stupid team, to quote you, Brian, but they were balanced, and you know, and I thought they did do enough in the end to give themselves a chance to win this one.
I think we need to give credit to Marvin. He was letting the ball fly last night. Yeah. 5 of 9 from 3-point line, and as always, he does well on the boards and does well on defense. And I do think that Porzingis actually had some success early, because, and I don't know if it's in Marvin's mindset or if it's the Hornets' mindset, he likes to help down a lot, whether it's someone that's maybe if it's Rose driving or whoever may be in the post, Melo. I think that's kind of why Porzingis was hitting the shots early, because Marvin was helping off of him a little bit. But on the offensive end, Marvin, you know, killed it from three, killed it.
I love when Marvin starts sticking trailer threes. I think, yeah, the offense takes on a different look when they're kind of coming on a secondary break and Marvin's trailing and they pitch back to him for three. It feels like it opens up everything else after that.
I mean, those are the easiest threes to make. Like, you catch them in stride. I mean, those mm-hmm. those threes are really easy to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, when Marvin is able to step into that jump shot from three, you know, and step into it, you know, there's a very high percentage of those are going in. That's a good point, Brian. It does open up everything for Charlotte, because, you know, if they get into that semi-fast break mode and Marvin is trailing the play, that draws a lot of defensive gravity towards the three-point line as the anxiety level rises, because if he catches and he's able to step into it again, you know, he's probably going to knock that thing down. So guys got to jump up to the three-point line on that kind of action. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, this year, you know, it feels like that was such – it was a much bigger fold to Charlotte's offense last year than it has been so far this year. Where that starts, to be honest, is Marvin getting on the glass more. You know, if he's able to get on the glass, hit the outlet, and then trail the play, and now naturally you're kind of into that action. But, you know, last night he only has three rebounds. But absolutely, great point, Richie. You know, give Marvin credit offensively. He's been a bright spot for the Hornets kind of during this 10-game struggle. That they've seen, 12-game struggle, whatever it is now, on both ends of the floor. He's attacking closeouts as he has all season long, and now we're starting to see that uptick from behind the arc, which it's going to need to continue if the Hornets expect to win some games, kind of as this roster is constructed right now. Anything else that we want to touch on in this New York game?
I mean, MKG's play again. I mean, he played well in Golden State, played well last night against the Knicks. Same things. Like, he's getting into those cutting lanes, finding, you know, those open lanes and getting those easy baskets at the rim. Not a lot of them were contested. And then I think he played great defense. Great defense on Melo.
I agree. And two things to add in here. I think the point of Jennings being dogging Kemba is spot on. Kemba was gassed, and they even tried running Kemba off some floppy, some single double stuff, and he just couldn't. I mean, he didn't have the burst to beat Jennings, you know, around an off the ball screen. One other positive, though, they did run with Frank at the 5 and Marvin at the 4 for 5 minutes last night, along with Kemba, Batum, and Kid Gilchrist. 105 points per 100 possessions, which is pretty good. A net rating of plus 35 defensively, only 70 points per 100 possessions. And if rebounding were a concern, they grabbed 100% of available defensive rebounds with Marvin at the four, MKG at the three, and Frank at the five. I kind of wish Clifford had actually tried this lineup a little bit down the stretch as opposed to making sure he had Hawes or Hibbert out there at the close of the game.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. It's the same conversation. I don't know why Clifford, you know, feels that he has to have a true center on the floor. You know, especially when Zeller's out. I mean, get creative. Like, why does Hawes need to be out there? And last night was a perfect example why Spencer Hawes is just not good at basketball. Offensively, you know, if he doesn't see an outside shot go in early, you know, he's going to make questionable decisions, which he did last night. Defensively, you might as well just play with four. Again, last night, for the most part, he's pretty much worthless out there. Cannot even, if you put him into a pick and roll situation, you're dead. You literally are playing with four defenders. So, you know, again, I don't know why we just don't, you know, why Clifford is not more open-minded to putting a guy like Marvin on the opposing team center if it's not, you know, one of the best behemoth centers in the league, which we weren't facing last night. But, you know, you live with the results, and we hope that Clifford will be more open-minded, you know, down the road, because I think the statistical support is there that you should try it more. The last thing I want to talk about in this game, I forgot this earlier, is Nick Batum. So he almost has a triple-double. So if you look at the box score, you say, man, wow, what a line. 15 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists. But I got to say, it didn't even feel like he really had that good of a game. I want to get your guys' thoughts on Nick Batum and his offensive inconsistency, low confidence recently, and then the turnovers. Like, they're just – the turnovers that Batum commits are – unforced errors. It feels like 100% of them, and I know that's not true. It's not 100% of them, but it feels like that, right? It feels like he's taking, and I know this is his game, right? Like, you have to live and die with this with Batum, but like, he's taking too many chances right now, and I can't imagine Clifford, a guy that preaches do not turn the ball over. I don't know how he's like stomachs watching Batum sometimes. I know he's dishing out a lot of assists, but these five turnover games, which we've seen far too many of recently, they've got to stop.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's becoming more of an occurrence in January, especially, you know, recently. He just, you know, last night he was leaving his feet and not knowing if he was going to shoot or pass. And then he had this one turnover, which is probably the worst of the game, where he left his feet and then he passed it out to Kemba near the top of the key. And it was a bad pass, and Rose just took it all the way for a layup. You know, you can't have turnovers at midcourt, especially with an explosive player like Rose. And in this month of January, he's averaging three turnovers a game, which is the highest of any month this year. So he's got to get that under control. And I think because he has these great passes, it gives him the confidence to kind of think that he can make any pass. So it is one of those things where you have to live with it, because that's the type of player that Batum is, because he does rack up those assists.
Yeah. So a few things that I've noticed recently, and Brian, I'll throw it to you.
Yeah.
Number one, teams have realized if you're physical with Batum, you're going to get him out of his game. So that's the first thing. And then that kind of leads into guarding the ball screen against Nick Batum, blitz him and bump him, you know, like, make sure there's some sort of contact. If you hedge really hard on that ball screen and he has to go into your body and make a play, and you kind of create that trap scenario defensively, he's going to make a bad decision. I feel like 60 to 70% of the time, he's going to throw the ball to the opposition. And I think teams have picked up on that. It's just kind of an eye test thing, but I feel like teams have been way more aggressive guarding him in the pick and roll here recently by just blitzing him and trapping him than I'd seen earlier in the season. And I think that just kind of leads back to be physical with him. That's the scouting report. You want to get him off his game, bump him, get up in his airspace, you know, make him work. If you're physical with Nick Batum, you're gonna make him very uncomfortable.
No doubt. And with Batum last night, of those five turnovers, two of them came in the fourth quarter when this team was kind of melting down. And Charlotte is a fun team. They play hard. They're connected. But because of the bench and some of the offensive limitations, the margins are so low. You know, it's one thing if the Golden State Warriors are going to be loose with the basketball, right? And they can, because it's going to, because they can get, they can rain a three, they can just bang a three down the next possession. Right. Charlotte's margins are so low, and it's just in these high leverage situations, you can't really afford having someone being kind of flip with the basketball like Batum is and was last night. And I think that is kind of bleeding over into his shooting. His numbers are down. I mean, not just from the field and not just from beyond the arc too. If you break it down even further, catch and shoot threes, he's at 34% this year. Last season, he was close to 37%. Pull up threes this season down to 27%. That was pull up threes last season, 31%. Here's kind of the real kicker: inside 10 feet, down to 53.8% this season. Last season, 63%. And again, kind of to your point of teams being a little physical with him when he has a quote unquote tight defender on him, 37%. That's a defender within 2 to 4 feet. An effective field goal percentage of 42%. And last season that was 39% and an effective field goal rate of 43%. So, but really his numbers are down shooting everywhere, and I think some of that physicality plays into it a little bit as well.
Yeah, and Brian, a lot less of Batum's offense in terms of field goal attempts are a lot less of those are coming from the 3-point line this year. I did that the other night, and I can't really put my finger. I probably need to look this up and do a little bit more research on this, but. You know, it feels like Batum shouldn't okay, so let me start. Less of the offense is coming from the 3-point line this year. He's not taking as many threes. So why is that? The logical reason would be to think, all right, so he's the ball handler more often. He's in the pick and roll more often. He's having to create more offense and be the number one distributor in Charlotte's offense, you know, with the starters. But that's not true, because it can't be true, because Kemba leads the league, or at least he's top three in pick and roll situations. His usage rate is the highest on the team. Yeah. So the truth to this is that Batum's confidence shooting the basketball has gone down, way down. And his, you know, the byproduct of that is that the amount of 3-point attempts that he's taken this year is down as well. That's the only way to explain it to me. I mean, I'd have to research it more. His confidence level is really down. He does not want to take that 3-point shot. I think that's another reason why you've kind of seen him come off these screens this year and hunt that defender that chases him around the screen, kind of make sure there's contact and then kind of flail his body up and draw that whistle. The Hornets have gotten really good at that. But like, if you're a confident shooter, you're coming off that action, you're getting the ball, and you're getting into your shot, right? Like you're getting up, you're letting it go. Batum's just that, you know, he's thinking his way too much through the game right now, instead of just playing basketball and reacting. And, you know, watching basketball and coaching, you know, and I coached high school for 4 or 5 years, you know, when a player is not confident in his offensive game, you know, he is doing those little things like catching, getting the ball out of his hands, catching, going to the rim, you know, looking for a body to bump into, something to take away from him getting in to, you know, to his shot, to his action, that he's just not real sure about. And when I watch Nick Batum right now, that's kind of what I see. I see a guy who's very uncertain about his jump shot, about where his offense is going to come from. But, you know, at the same time, the stuff has got to go through him. You know, if it's not going through Kemba, it's got to go through him. And so Batum's got to figure this stuff out pretty quickly.
I agree. His 3-point attempt rate is down to 39% this year. So, you know, 2 out of 5 shots he takes, give or take, come from beyond the arc. It was about 46% last season. What I will say is he is getting to the free throw line a little bit more, and he's turning it over a little less this year, which is kind of one of the reasons why his some of his kind of catch-all efficiency numbers, like PER and win shares per 48, BPM, they're similar, basketball plus-minus, they're similar to what they were a season ago, but he's still not really giving us what we need. And I think part of the – maybe I should hesitate to say we there, but – I think one of the issues is people who follow the team, fans, media, whatever. Maybe we expected and now need more out of Batum with some of the offseason departures and with the extension that he signed in the last summer, and it just really hasn't quite been there. He's still kind of about the same player, just not shooting as well from the field, and that's a little disappointing because I think everyone was probably hoping to see an uptick in all of that stuff. And in fact, they need it now, especially without guys like Lynn and Lee and Al Jefferson too.
That's a good point, especially with that second unit. When they place him in that second unit, we're going to need more from him offensively.
Right.
And he's just not, he's not bringing it. He's not bringing it. Right. And his confidence is real low.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's Charlotte paid him to be that guy. You know, they gave him the massive contract to be the second guy next to Kemba. And, you know, Brian, you might be right. Maybe, you know, maybe he just is what he is. And we expect him to be, you know, more now with you know, the losses that we had to the roster from last season, where he didn't have to be that guy as much. But, you know, Charlotte has paid him to be that, and this is Batum's opportunity in this league to, you know, to prove, you know, that he can be the cog of a roster, or at least one of those. And you know, this second half of the season is going to be very, very telling for Nick Batum. You know, Richie and I have talked about this. There's a lot of different ways that Charlotte can go, you know, not only as the trade deadline approaches, but, you know, into the offseason. It feels like they have the core together, but everything has to be built around Kemba. And, you know, if this continues, if Batum continues to struggle, you know, in efficiency offensively and just maybe doesn't prove to be a great fit next to Kemba Walker, you know, do we start asking the question, all right, you know, they can probably move Batum. Should we kind of hit a little mini reset here and see what we can get? You know, I don't think that question's off the table either, because I think there's plenty of proof, but there's some proof in the pudding here that Kemba and Batum might not be as an incredible of a fit as a lot of people wanted to think at the end of last season. And I think that, Brian, your point about the guys that we lost off this roster have made that more glaring, but you know, we'll continue to monitor that through the second half of the season. Let's talk about something a little bit more positive, and that is Kemba Walker being named an Eastern Conference NBA All-Star, the first one in Charlotte since Gerald Wallace in 2010. Kemba is now the seventh All-Star in Charlotte franchise history, next to again, Gerald Wallace. Larry Johnson was twice as a Hornet. Alonzo Mourning was twice as a Hornet. Glenn Rice was three times as a Hornet. Eddie Jones once, and Baron Davis once. Man, it feels good. It feels really good. You know, as negative as things have been here in the past, but really in January for the Hornets, to get an All-Star, to get a guy in front of a, you know, a national TV audience and really in front of the entire league wearing a Hornets jersey, you know, it makes you proud. If you've been a fan for a really long time since the beginning of this whole thing, which I certainly have, and I'm sure you guys have, kind of give me one or two things, positive thoughts about Kemba being named an All-Star. Richie, we'll start with you.
Just kind of piggyback off what you're saying. It's a great honor for him, but it's hard to get excited for this because with the way that our team is playing, kind of like, you know, lessens the excitement about this. And I'm sure that Kemba would trade this All-Star if this team would turn around. But one thing that I just want to take a note of with Kemba that I love, you guys might give measurable things. I love his intangibles, okay? Like his toughness, his grittiness. He sparks our offense when it's down. And we saw that yesterday against the Knicks in the second quarter when that offense was just struggling. Clifford had to put him back in towards the end of the second quarter, and he sparked like a mini run to give us some confidence heading into the halftime there. And he just gets our players involved, the crowd involved. They all feed off of him. And then another thing, intangibles on defense, we talked about this last episode, he will go through those screens. He's underrated on defense. He withstands the contact. He's top three in the NBA with 19 charges taken. So the little things like that, I don't think we give enough credit for Kemba. I mean, you know, obviously the shooting percentages are up, you know, the points are up, but let's look at his intangibles too. And that's kind of what I love about Kemba.
I agree with everything you said. You know, I don't know where basketball, professional basketball in North Carolina would be without this guy. I mean, the stats bear it out. I mean, it's impossible to say, you know, if they don't draft this guy in 2011, you know, what happened. We can't go back 6 years and retrace everything. But it's hard to imagine where the NBA would be without in North Carolina without Kemba. He means so much to this team. And, you know, he's one of the best value players in the NBA, too. I think a lot of people kind of in 2014 kind of poked fun at some of the most respected basketball minds in the media kind of thought Charlotte was crazy to give this guy a $48 million contract, which now might be, I think I'm guessing Steel. along with Isaiah Thomas and Steph Curry, that there isn't a cheaper All-Star in the game this year. I would need to double check that, but right about $12 million a year. That's just the value is incredible. But he doesn't. He's never once mentioned it. I mean, you hear Beal and Wall. All this comes out of Washington. They're playing better, but you hear Wall all the time complaining. And I'm not knocking. If I were John Wall, I would be upset about it too. But Kemba doesn't say a single word. He just goes out there and plays his you know what off every freaking game, even though he's criminally underpaid and will be for the next couple of years too. And he's just a super fun player to watch, and we're lucky to have him here.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you guys both make awesome points. You know, I like the guy that Kemba is. You know, I like the person that he is. The competitor that he is such rare air. You just don't see guys that play that hard on both ends of the court. You know, but again, along with how hard he plays, you know, it's what he does or really doesn't do and doesn't say off the court. He's all about business. He's the consummate team guy. He's the perfect personality and character for this Charlotte Hornets franchise. You know, a franchise that's built off of a culture of hard work. Clifford says it before the New York game last night. You know, he there's a quote saying, "I can't imagine, you know, because of the leadership of Kemba Walker, MKG, and guys like Marvin Williams, that anybody, any team in this league is working harder than we are." And we all know, you know, the talent deficiency on the roster. But, you know, Kemba epitomizes everything that this franchise has become. And the hard work, you know, the defense, the grittiness, the never quit. I mean, all of that goes through him. So, you know, to your point, Brian, without him, I have no idea where basketball is in the city. And I'm not so sure it's still not the laughing stock of the NBA, you know, mm-hmm. But what's really, you know, what I thought about the other night, you know, when his face and name pops up on the TNT and he's named an all-star is remembering where that guy was in his first 2 years, really first 3 years of his career. You know, a lot of people were asking into that third year, you know, is Kemba going to make it in the NBA? Yeah, he can't shoot. He's never going to be able to shoot. You know, teams are just going to sag under him. He's not big enough, you know, to make a difference on the defensive end. He's not good at finishing at the rim, you know. So what is he really bringing? You know, people were seriously questioning, you know, if this guy was going to be a long-term NBA player. And here he is as an all-star. It all comes full circle and points to his personality, what kind of person he is. He's that kind of guy. He's that human that you tell him he can't do something, he's going to do it. And he showed it throughout his life, throughout his career, winning a national championship at UConn. You know, he plays with that heart, and he plays with that, you know, unquestionable mentality. And I have to say, I'm biased. We're all biased, obviously, but I can't imagine there's an all-star out there that deserves it more than Kemba Walker. So, Kemba, you're probably not going to listen to this, but keep playing the way you're playing and keep doing what you're doing, because we're proud of you, and you make Charlotte Hornets basketball really, really easy to watch and really easy to pull for. So anything else that you guys want to mention before we move on from this?
Just to kind of highlight, there's a million stats you could point out with this guy, but I would like to just pick this out. It's kind of the fearlessness of this guy. NBA defines clutch situations as fourth quarter overtime, under 5 minutes, score within 5 points. And if you ever question whether this guy should be an all-star or not, he has 89 points in these clutch situations. That's number 9 in the NBA. He's shooting 51% from the field in clutch situations. Here's a list of players that's better than. Russell Westbrook, Isaiah Thomas, Damian Lillard, DeMarcus Cousins, Jimmy Butler, John Wall, DeMar DeRozan, James Harden, Mike Conley, Kyle Lowry, and Kawhi Leonard. The only like notable guys better than that shooting percentage in these clutch situations, LeBron and Paul George and CJ McCollum. I mean, he is, if you haven't seen this guy play, if I lived in Portland, I would want to watch Kemba play because he's one of the best players in the league. He's nasty in the pick and roll, and there are a million numbers you could point to back that up.
Right,
he's maybe the best in the league, but man, in the fourth quarter, and especially when they need a bucket, he is fearless and he's awesome too. So that's really, really fun to watch.
He's incredible to watch, and Charlotte's lucky to have him. And we're going to need all of that, and probably a little bit more for the Hornets to get back on track in the second half of this season. Let's kind of go back to that bench discussion we were having earlier. Here's the question I would present, and you guys can just jump in here. Can the Hornets make the playoffs with this bench unit as currently constructed? Or is it just kind of a matter of time before they fall below that eight seed in the Eastern Conference? You know, can this bench unit get them there, or is it inevitable you have to have a trade to get to the playoffs?
To get to the playoffs, I think that we could make it with this bench. I mean, we've seen the ups and downs with this bench throughout the year. We would probably be a 7 or 8 seed with this bench. We definitely wouldn't make any noise in the playoffs with the way that this bench is currently constructed. And obviously, we need to get people back healthy with like Zeller, because that's definitely shortening, you know, the depth in that department. So to answer your question, yes, we can make the playoffs, but I don't think that it would be, you know, a 4 or 5 or 6 seed with this team.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that too. I think kind of the goal, at least for me heading into the season, was I was hopeful that they could maybe host a first round playoff series and kind of get to that 4 line. And I agree with Richie with the way the bench is currently constructed and playing. I just don't see that as a realistic possibility without some addition.
Yeah, I definitely don't. I think it's time to start understanding that, you know, minus a small miracle, the Hornets are not going to host a playoff series. I mean, Washington's playing way, way, way too good. Probably the best in the NBA right now, honestly. Boston is locked into a top 4 seed. I mean, obviously you got Cleveland and Toronto. So, you know, I don't think there's any way. But, you know, I think the Hornets can probably still make the playoffs as currently constructed. I would probably tell you that it's going to be an 8 seed. I think Chicago's just still better from top to bottom on their roster than Charlotte right now. But there's still enough of a traffic jam in the middle of that Eastern Conference to where the Hornets could jump up to the 5 or 6 seed, you know, if they can make some traction in this trade deadline. You know, if they can make some kind of significant move to get a guy that can play with the bench but also play with Kemba late and Batum late in games as kind of a second scorer. I don't know who that guy is. You know, Richie and I we've talked numerous times, you know, about possible scenarios. And we can spend a few minutes on that, Brian, maybe if you have some ideas. But yeah, so to answer that question, I think they can make it, but by just barely with this roster is currently constructed. So, Brian, are there any have you tossed around any trade ideas or thought about some trade ideas for the Hornets as kind of that second scorer?
Yeah, I think, and I kind of think all of us who follow this team are kind of kicking around the same names, right? And I haven't exactly gone on to the ESPN trade machine and played around with that too much, but
good.
I mean, you guys know the names, you know, Wilson Chandler from the Nuggets. Richie, I think you and I were kind of tweeting about that semi-recently.
Yeah.
Will Barton from the Nuggets. There was discussion over Brandon Knight of the Suns, but you know, he's under contract through 2020. He's currently in year 2 of a 5-year $70 million contract. So I'm not sure that's feasible. I saw someone the other night toss out Ricky Rubio. I don't really see that one as a great fit, and he's signed through 2019 and owed $32 million including this season. You know, the PJ Tucker is a name that gets pushed out a lot, Ben McLemore and Darren Collison from the Kings. But these guys are they're all fine, but it always comes down to what are you giving up to get these guys? And, you know, again, the rotation is so razor thin right now that it's tough to see the kind of Jenga effect that might happen if you pulled out, oh, if we trade Jeremy Lamb, well then, you know, what does that do? I'd love to see them get a shooter. You know, Will Barton is a pie-in-the-sky kind of guy because he can shoot threes and create his own shot. I like Wilson Chandler a lot, too, just because he can play a couple positions and hit some threes, although he's like right around league average this year. But any of those guys that can create their own shot, play a couple positions, and hit threes, I would take any of them, especially if they're not, you know, a guy like Brandon Knight who's under contract for 3 more seasons after this one, too.
Yeah, Those are all very interesting names. I think Will Barton is kind of quietly becoming the most interesting guy at this trade deadline. I mean, you know, you have your obvious names, Carmelo Anthony being one of them. Probably nothing happens there. But yeah. Will Barton on a massively underpaid guy for some offensive firepower off the bench. Just go look at his numbers. If you guys listeners get a chance, he's doing awesome things for Denver off the bench. And it's not just this year. I mean, Will Barton, I think his coming out party was last season. He's making 3.5 this year. He's going to make 3.5 next year. The Nuggets are going to be asking something for him. They're going to be asking for a real asset coming back. We'll see who's most desperate and willing to pay the price, but I wouldn't count the Hornets out there if the Nuggets make him available. And, you know, that remains to be seen, because as it stands today, if I'm not mistaken, they're still in the 8 seed out in the West. So, you know, I think they may want to just keep seeing what this roster can do. I mean, they really want Jokic and the rest of those young guys out there to develop. So I don't see why they don't just go ahead and chase the playoffs. But if they do make Barton available, I think the Hornets are aggressive in trying to land him. So I think that's a very interesting name to watch.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. But the issue is, wouldn't they want defense? And do we have any to offer? I mean, I would definitely love Barton on this team. I think he would provide a scoring punch off the bench. He, like you said, his salary is pretty low. But in terms of what they would be asking for us, they would need defense, correct? I mean, I don't think we have anything to offer in that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean,
Lamb's the one guy, maybe, you know, maybe Lamb, but like that, but I mean, he's not like a stopper or anything like that, you know,
right.
But there's not much in the kind of in the arsenal in terms of that, though.
Yeah, there's not much in the basket for the Hornets to part ways with. You know, it would probably, and here's what it's going to come down to. If the Hornets want to land a guy who can come in and seriously help, because they don't have, you know, an asset in terms of a real human basketball player on the roster that they can move and make a difference with right now, they're going to have to part ways with a first-round draft pick. And if, you know, Cho is a smart enough guy, if he could put the right protections on that pick, I think you can – I mean, the national media will tell you it's a retarded deal for Charlotte no matter what they do. But, you know, I would beg to offer the thought that if they put the right protections on it, that they can send out a first-round pick for a guy – you know, like Will Barton, and it makes some sense down the road. I mean, you know, it kind of like in the form of what Marco Bellinelli was to Charlotte. You know, people still want to tell you that was a bad deal for Charlotte. And, you know, Malachi Richardson might end up being something, but Bellinelli has been the only reason the Hornets have actually even been a real NBA bench this season, especially earlier in the year. So, you know, sometimes you got to give up future assets, quote unquote, however you define that and value that, you know, to get guys that can come help right now. And on top of all that, I think the Hornets are, you know, they want to win now. I mean, there's not, they could, you know, have a mini reset, but that's not the plan. You know, I think we all know the plan is to win now, win this season. So it might be time to start having that conversation about, all right, do we need to part ways with the future first? I mean, do we want to get better now, or do we want to just keep running this thing back with a near 500 team with this roster as it's constructed? And I think there's enough evidence there to show you that, you know, that's not going to get you real far, you know. So is it this season they're going to make that move? I don't know, but that move is going to come at some point, and I think it's at least willing. I think it's time to at least start having the conversation seriously now.
I think we can all agree that we need offense, right? Like, you guys both agree that that's what we need.
Yeah, definitely. The Hornets are close to top five in defensive efficiency, but they're middle of the pack in points per possession on offense. So, I think they need scoring and shooting.
It's just painful to watch that bench unit. Just that's what we need.
Man.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't really. The bench unit is – I don't know if there is an answer for that. I mean, they're struggling on both ends of the court. You know, Clifford's just trying to buy minutes with them and – you just hope the team can stay in the game. But yeah, I mean, I think the answer to the question is definitely the most important need is offense at the end of the game next to Kemba, you know, when you try to hold these leads. But all right, so here's a fun discussion I wanted to have. Brian, you and I were going back and forth about it a little bit earlier. I know you're an ACC basketball guy. So here's what I want to ask you first. Are you as in-depth with your stats about ACC basketball as you are with the Hornets?
I'd like to think that I am. So actually my full-time job is I actually write for this publication called the ACC Sports Journal or accsports.com. And, I have my Synergy Sports, subscription. There aren't as many good publicly available college basketball stats. The NBA does a fantastic job making a lot of this stuff, easy to find with just a few minutes of research. But yeah, I think I've got some decent stuff on some college prospects too, specifically within the confines of the ACC.
All right, awesome. So as the Hornets, you know, continue on this downslide here, you know, there might come a day where we find ourselves in the lottery this season or having this conversation about prospects more seriously. But tell me, what is your who's your favorite draft prospect in the ACC right now, and why?
My favorite draft prospect in the ACC. He's not falling to the Hornets, because I think even if they land in the lottery, they're not going to get a top three or four pick. Dennis Smith Jr. from NC State is just the real deal. I was in Cameron this past Monday to watch them beat Duke, and he was just incredible. And I wrote something on this yesterday. The last six half court possessions they had in that game against Duke, Smith scored or assisted on every basket. And on five of those six possessions, the state did the same thing. They put two shooters in the corners, and then they stacked Abdul Malik Abu and Maverick Rowan at the top, and they like staggered them at the top of the key. And then we're running a high ball screen with Abu off Smith, and he was either going to the hoop, or if that wasn't there, then Rowan was setting a back pick on Abu's guy, and he was looking for Abu on rolls, lobs. And they also tried another time too, where Abu then just went and set a little down screen, and Rowan curled off of it for a three. So Dennis Smith Jr. is my favorite. I think if there weren't the one and done rule in place, Dennis Smith Jr. would be playing for an NBA team right now. And everyone says he can get more athletic because he's still recovering from ACL surgery, which is scary. Because if you saw the dunk he threw down at the end of the game, it's tough to think of a guy being more explosive than that. He's my favorite guy, and then another guy that I like a lot, who is probably kind of close, kind of in the top 10 as far as prospects go, Jonathan Isaac at Florida State is a really, really special player. He's a great on cuts, putbacks, and he's a pretty good catch-and-shoot guy. He's got guard skills for a dude who's 6'10", 6'11", and he kind of floats between the three and the four and hangs out on the perimeter. If you could somehow get Jonathan Isaac, I think he has the chance to be not only a starter in the NBA, but could be you don't ever forecast these guys as all stars. It's way too early. He's 19 years old or whatever. But I think Isaac has the ability to become a seriously plus NBA player. However you kind of quantify or define that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're right about Dennis Smith. He's the best prospect in the ACC and probably a shoe-in top three pick. You think that would be accurate? And then Isaac's interesting. So he's a lot of work to do on his body. He's still rail thin, but his measurables are kind of – they're off the chart. So he's that prototypical stretch – you know, he's a prototypical power forward in the NBA as the game is played today. You know, he can play inside out. He can guard four positions, maybe five positions. You know, so I think when it's all said and done, you're right. Isaac should be a lottery pick and probably out of the Hornets' wheelhouse. Well, maybe, unless they're in the lottery, which is definitely still possible. Right. So my favorite guy, not the best prospect, but my favorite prospect in the ACC is Dwayne Bacon. I watched him here in Charlottesville. Literally single-handedly he was incredible. I mean, I have not seen a performance like that against Virginia, which you know because you watch a lot of basketball. I mean, that's the best defense in the ACC. It's the toughest defense to score on. And Dwayne Bacon made it look like child's play. And the way he played at the end of the game in terms of wanting the basketball, that takes a supreme confidence. And I wasn't quite sure that he could be that kind of scorer that consistently. And the draft boards are still not giving him enough respect. But give me a little bit of insight on what you think about Dwayne Bacon. I think he's a first-round pick, but a lot of sites would still tell you otherwise, and I don't think he's getting the respect he deserves right now.
I'm with you. I think he's a first round pick too. And if you got him anywhere outside of the lottery, you could be pretty happy about it. Just looking at some of his numbers here, he's one of the best players in the ACC in transition, according to Synergy, shooting 64% from the field in transition. That's in the 86th percentile nationally. He's a good offensive rebounder. He's shooting 60% on putbacks this season. And he's operated in the pick and roll as a ball handler a fair amount. 16% of his possessions have been out of the pick and roll. And again, like you said, not only is Virginia a great defensive team, they've just been notorious the last probably 4 years as far as if they're going up against a good offensive perimeter player, they take that guy out of the game. I've seen it with Cat Barber at NC State. I saw it with TJ Warren. Now, normally it was Malcolm Brogdon doing this, and we see how he's blossomed to a pretty darn good NBA player already with the Bucks. But Bacon doing what he did and sticking that game winner. I think after I think it was a guy that kind of hit the go ahead shot for Virginia, and then Bacon came right back down. And you know, they run him off down screens, but he can go get his own shot too. And he's a really impressive player. He's one of those guys who maybe could have bounced after last season, but came back and has taken his game to another level. He's shooting 42% on catch and shoots this season. There's no doubt this guy can play in the NBA, and I think any team would be happy to have him as a wing that can really provide some serious offensive scoring punch.
Yeah, and I think your point to him playing 16% of his possessions out of the pick and roll this season, that's the question, right? Like, can he be a creator with the ball? I think we know he can score. I think everyone knows he has an NBA-ready body. He's only 6'5", but if you look at him, you would mistake him to be 6'7", or 6'8", just because his body is already that filled out, and he's going to be able to hold his own defensively, especially in the NBA on day one. So he should be able to contribute right away. To answer your question, yes, it was. The UVA runs a little hammer action. They hit guy in the corner. Yep. He sticks the three with about 10 seconds left to give UVA a one-point lead. The place is going nuts. I thought, this game is over. I mean, there's no way Florida State can answer this call. Bacon demands the ball, dribbles up the court, pulls right up in every single UVA defender's face and sticks it to win that game. And for his 30th point of the day, and I thought, wow, this kid, he's a player. I mean, he's going to be really good on the next level. So it's a guy to keep in mind for the Hornets. I think he's probably in play for that middle of the first round, maybe, 17 to 25 range. So it's certainly a name to keep in mind about, for the Hornets.
I agree. And he stuck that shot, that Bacon made that game-winning shot over Isaiah Wilkins, who is probably Virginia's best defender this year and is a bigger defender too. I thought that was pretty impressive of Bacon there. I'd also keep an eye on, not to go off on another tangent here, and I won't, but I think Justin Jackson at UNC is having a great year. He's a guy that threw his name in the draft waters last season, came back. He's a 6'8 wing, and he's sticking catch and shoot threes, running them off pin downs, running out elevator door plays for North Carolina. And also, he's one of those guys who his efficiency numbers out of pick and roll and isolation are some of the best in the conference. And the ACC is a powerhouse this year. And watching him dominate has been really impressive. So he's another guy, I think, maybe a little bit lower prospect than Bacon, but I think he's another one of those guys that will go mid to late first round and can be a player from day one in the NBA too.
Yeah, I like Jackson. He's had a little bit of a – he's had an interesting college career. I think a lot of Carolina fans would tell you they've been frustrated with him. I think this year he's been the most consistent that he's been. He's a senior, right? Is that right, Brian?
He's a junior. No, junior. Third-year guy.
He's a junior. So that changes the conversation a little bit. He's one of the guys that's going to need to come in – to any team, and probably because of his age, be ready to go day one, right? Like, you're going to need to get in minutes right away. I don't know if that's the deal for Bacon, kind of in the Malik Beasley situation. You know, he hasn't really played this season last year coming out of Florida State. I don't know that Bacon needs to come in right away and contribute. So I think in the end, he's probably a little better of a prospect. But another name I wanted to mention, and he hasn't had a good year. Last year, he had a ridiculous season, and that's Jerome Blossom game for Clemson. Go ahead.
Oh no, my apologies. I was just tossing it out there. Shooting has just fallen off a cliff. But yeah, keep. Exactly. I didn't mean to interrupt you here.
Yeah, no. And that's the question that scouts are going to have to answer with him is this kind of just a regression to the mean? Is this an outlier or is this more Blossom game? Is he going to struggle to shoot the ball at the next level? I mean, I think a guy like Malcolm Brogdon, that's a good. It's not a comp, but we've seen. The question marks about him being able to shoot the ball on the next level were real, but he's shown that he can stretch it all the way to the three-point line in the NBA. I think you watch Blossom game shoot the basketball, you look at his form, it's not broken, and I would say it's a lot better than Brogdon's is, to be honest. There's not that hitch, there's not the weird release, but he's just struggling this year. But, I mean, there's a guy who can guard 1 through 4. He can handle the basketball. I think he's close. Probably not as good of a prospect as Jonathan Isaac, but he's close to that prototypical power forward in the NBA. Probably can play some small forward in stretches. But just a few quick thoughts on Blossom game for you, Brian.
I'm a big fan, despite the shooting has fallen off a cliff. But I think heading into the season, he was even viewed by some scouts as the guy who could be the best senior in the draft this year, entering the best 4-year player entering the draft this year. I like the thought of him as a stretch four in the NBA, as a guy that can switch out guard the, you know, the two, three fours. And if he does find, he's super athletic and he can put on the deck just a little bit. And if he could find that shooting touch again, I mean, he could really be a special player. But it is crazy to see how it is. Like last year, on catch and shoot attempts, Blossom game, 1.4 points per possession. That was the third best number in the ACC in the 97th percentile nationally this season, down to just 0.32 points per possession on 10.8% shooting. That's out of catch and shoots. That ranks 95th out of 97 qualified ACC players who have 10 or more catch and shoots this season, which is just, it's just inexplicable. It seems crazy that it makes me wonder if he's even like hurt or something, because a simple regression to the mean is this guy hitting 30% of these, not hitting 10% of them, you know? I mean, it's just, it's crazy. That said, I'm still high on him as a prospect, and I still see him landing in the back end of a lot of first rounds. So he'd be a guy that, if I were picking towards the end of the first round, I would be pretty excited to have play, just because I think he's a great athlete. He can play a couple positions, and he's flashed, at least for one season of his college career, the ability to hit threes.
I think we should draft him just because of his name.
Yes,
it is a pretty sweet name. Blossom game, yeah.
It's an amazing name.
All right, so a few things here. Number one, Brian, this is my favorite conversation to have about basketball, evaluating draft prospects. So we're going to do more of this, and I can tell by just hearing you talk about it that you like it just as much as I do. So we're going to have you on more and talk about this more. Richie, the second thing is this. Richie's learning a lot here. He's going to learn to love the draft process, and I'm going to force him to watch more college basketball, especially ACC. So he's kind of in the learning phases here, and he's probably just rolling his eyes at me as I say this.
You'll definitely have to bring Brian on more often when it comes closer to the draft. I cannot get into college basketball that much like you guys do, and that's probably sacrilege here in, you know, ACC County. That's why I didn't chime in on that conversation, listeners. I just don't watch it, so I can't really add anything to it.
He doesn't yet. He doesn't yet, but he will. So, all right. I think that's going to have to do it, guys. We've gone too long, but some really good conversation today. Brian, again, really appreciate you coming on. Brian, go ahead and anything you want to plug, tell people again where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find you on the interwebs, all your good stuff.
First off, thanks again for having me on. This was super fun. I'd love, my favorite conversations usually are finding guys to kind of geek out about the NBA, specifically the Hornets with. There aren't too many people I get to do that with. So this is a lot of fun for me. And, you can find me on Twitter at BGEIS_Bird on Twitter. And you can find my work in a couple different places. ACCSports.com or the ACC Sports Journal. I mostly write stats pieces on ACC basketball. And, of course, you can also find me at Sports Channel 8. That's where all of my Hornets content is. And I do some podcasts with my partner, Brendan Whitted. We do a Hornets podcast, maybe not with quite the same regularity as you guys, but we talk some Hornets there. And you know, that's usually where you'll find me writing about and just heaping praise on top of how awesome Kemba Walker is. And so, yeah, that's at sportschannel8.com and at sportschannel8 on Twitter. And, of course, like Spencer said earlier, make sure to check out the ACC GIF recaps. They're better than any of the actual statistical research I do. They're much more fun. So
maybe that'll get me into college basketball.
Right. If anything, hopefully it can do that. And I work with some great guys at both those sites. And some of the guys from Sports Channel 8, Ben Swain, Hayes Permar, Weather Moose, Josh Goodson. All these guys are really good dudes. And if you see them on Twitter or anything like that, any of their work, they're some of the best voices we have in this area on college hoops and on a couple other things too. So keep an eye out for all those guys at Sports Channel 8.
All right, awesome. That's all good stuff. I am familiar with all those guys. You said the name Ben Swain. I know he's. Let's just put it this way. He's not a UVA basketball guy. And
no, he's not. He's not.
Yeah, he is not. I get it though. He's a Duke guy. Very opposite programs. Very opposite styles of basketball. But look, we Brian, you and I need to get on and talk about the ACC separate sometime because it's going to be too easy of us to go down a rabbit hole here. But but all right, Richie, tell everyone where they can find us, subscribe, and listen to us on the go.
We do have a variety of places in which you guys can check us out. BuzzBeat can be found on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/BuzzBeat. You can also download the Stitcher app or search us on iTunes by just searching BuzzBeat and we'll come up. And once again, guys, just rate us and review us on iTunes. That would be great. And we just wanted to thank you guys for all your support so far.
All right, awesome. Again, this was really fun, Brian. We will have you on again. We'll be back next week. I'm not sure what day, probably Saturday. Saturday seems to be working out well. The Hornets will be in the middle of a West Coast trip, and if they don't get this one tonight against Sacramento at home, we might be really having a morbid conversation. So let's hope that doesn't happen. But again, thanks for the support, and until next time, we'll see you guys then. Thanks.